So I want you to imagine a king who is just so terrified of losing his crown that he leaves this standing order with his personal bodyguard. And he says, if I die on my upcoming business trip, immediately murder my wife so no one else can have her.
Yeah, which is just wild. It's not like a pitch for some dark premium cable television drama.
Right. But no, that was the actual daily reality of the man we generally know simply as the ultimate villain of the Christmas story.
The monster lurking in the background of the nativity, basically. I mean, most people only know him for ordering the, you know, the slaughter of the innocents.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because today, we are taking a deep dive into the real Herod the Great. And we're pulling all of this from a really fascinating lecture by Dr. Anthony J. Tomasino.
Yeah, from his series, Judaism Before Jesus. It's a fantastic resource.
It really is. And our mission today is to understand this incredible, almost impossible paradox. Because we are looking at a man who was, on one hand, a deeply paranoid tyrant who murdered his own beloved wife and his own sons.
But then on the other hand, he simultaneously engineered some of the greatest architectural wonders of the ancient world. And he single-handedly secured legal rights for Jews across the entire Roman Empire.
Which is just a crazy contrast.
It really is. I mean, put yourself in Herod's shoes for a second.
Yeah.
You are trying to govern a fractured, rebellious population that fundamentally rejects your bloodline.
Yeah, they literally hate him.
They do. And meanwhile, your mother-in-law is actively plotting against you with the Queen of Egypt.
Yeah.
And, you know, you are desperately trying to keep the Roman Empire the global superpower that could crush you in an afternoon, happy enough to keep you on the throne.
It is basically a masterclass in ruthless political survival.
Yeah.
But to really understand the intense paranoia that defined his later life, we actually had to start with his massive foundational insecurity. He was never supposed to be king.
Right. What's so fascinating here is how deeply his background disqualified him in the eyes of his own subjects. So Herod was the son of Antipater, the Roman-appointed governor of Idumea.
Which made Herod of Edomite descent.
Exactly. And to the Judean people he was trying to rule, being an Edomite meant he was basically only half Jewish.
And we should probably pause on that, because in the ancient world, that distinction carried, like, centuries of baggage.
Oh, massive historical baggage. The rivalry between the Judeans and the Edomites traced all the way back to the biblical brothers Jacob and Esau. Traditional law actually stated that no Edomite could enter the assembly of the Lord until the seventh generation.
Wow.
So right out of the gate, the populace views him as a total usurper. He isn't from the traditional ancient line of King David, and crucially, he isn't from the Hasmonean family.
The Hasmoneans being the legendary heroes who had, you know, successfully revolted against the Greeks and ruled Judea as an independent kingdom for a century. To the people, the Hasmoneans were undisputed royalty. And Herod was basically a middle management nobody.
A nobody who suddenly finds himself running for his life. Around 40 BC, a Hasmonean named Antigonus invades Judea with the backing of the Parthian Empire. He appoints himself king and high priest, and Herod just has to flee the region completely.
He just books it.
Yeah, he heads toward Egypt, hoping to find his Roman ally, Mark Antony. But Antony has already left for Rome.
And the mechanics of what Herod does next are just wild. He's a deposed, deeply unpopular son of a governor, literally on the run. Yet he manages to borrow a staggering amount of money from various wealthy individuals across the Mediterranean.
That's incredible.
He essentially acts like an ancient venture capitalist, pitching himself as a high-risk, high-reward startup. He promises them massive returns once he reclaims the tax base of Judea, and he uses that massive influx of cash to literally buy his way to Rome.
Right. He arrives in Rome and immediately uses that borrowed money to bribe Mark Antony and other key figures.
Yeah.
And the strategy works flawlessly.
It actually worked.
It did. Antony goes before the Roman Senate and proposes making Herod the king of Judea. The Senate agrees, officially granting him the title in 40 BC.
This is like a deeply unpopular mid-level manager taking out a massive personal loan to buy out the entire company and then having to show up to the office with a private security firm just to sit at the CEO's desk.
That is a perfect way to put it.
Because having the title on parchment didn't magically give him the kingdom. He literally had to raise a mercenary army, convince the Romans to finally send back up troops and fight a brutal war for 3 years just to breach the walls of Jerusalem and have Antigonus executed.
Yeah. And having seized that CEO's desk by sheer military force, Herod realizes he has a massive public relations crisis. How do you legitimize your rule to a populace that violently rejects your authority?
Right.
So his solution is his first truly ruthless political calculation. He banishes his first wife, a woman named Doris, along with their son. He simply erases them from his public life.
So he basically clears the board to make room for a strategic alliance.
Exactly. He marries a woman named Mary Homney. She is a Hasmonean princess. By marrying her, Herod is desperately hoping her undisputed royal blood will serve as a shield, basically validating his throne in the eyes of the Judean people.
But marrying a Hasmonean princess didn't calm the waters, did it? I mean, it just dragged his worst enemies directly into his living room, which kicks off a decade of absolute cutthroat consolidation. He realizes he can't just rely on his wife's bloodline. He has to actively dismantle the existing power structures.
If we connect this to the bigger picture of authoritarian rule, his first target is highly strategic. He goes after the Sanhedrin.
The religious council, right?
Yeah, the supreme religious and civil council of the Jewish people. They had been the steadying presence in Judea, acting almost like a supreme court. Herod systematically strips them of all their civil authority.
Wow, just guts their power.
Completely. He turns them from a governing body into essentially a theological debate club. The ultimate authority now stops solely with him.
Neutering the supreme court was one thing, but his most dangerous domestic threat was actually his new mother-in-law, Alexandra, and she treated him with open, blatant contempt. Normally, a dictator like Herod would have just quietly had an annoying rival poisoned, but Alexandra was untouchable. Her best friend happened to be Queen Cleopatra of Egypt.
Yeah, and Cleopatra had her own grand ambitions. She constantly whispered in Mark Antony's ear, asking him to strip Judea from Herod and give the territory to her.
Just giving away the kingdom.
Right, and the motivation wasn't just spite. It was pure economics. The region around Jericho produced some of the most lucrative date palms and balsam in the Middle East. She wanted a monopoly on those luxury exports.
Makes sense.
Dr. Tomasino actually references Blaise Pascal's famous quip here. He said, if Cleopatra's nose had been shorter, the whole face of the world would have been changed.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's a nod to Roman beauty standards where a prominent nose indicated strength and allure. Cleopatra used that allure to maintain immense influence over Antony.
And Alexandra uses that exact pipeline. She complains to Cleopatra, who pressures Mark Antony, who then forces Herod to make Alexandra's son, Herod's 16-year-old brother-in-law, Aristobulus, the new high priest.
Yeah, talk about a threat.
Seriously, you suddenly have a 16-year-old kid in the most sacred role in the culture. He's incredibly handsome, he has the Hasmonean royal blood, and the crowds go wild for him. He is a walking, breathing replacement for Herod.
And Herod recognizes the existential threat immediately. Following a festival, Herod invites the young high priest to cool off in a massive swimming pool at his winter palace in Jericho.
A cool party, basically.
A deadly one. They are roughhousing with some of Herod's servants in the water, and the 16-year-old high priest conveniently drowns.
Wait, hold on. I'm stuck on something here. Alexandra immediately knows it was a political assassination. She tells Cleopatra that Herod blatantly murdered the high priest. Cleopatra tells Mark Antony, demanding justice. How does a mid-level client king like Herod survive angering the queen of Egypt and the most powerful general in Rome?
It's a great question, and it really highlights the stark difference between our modern moral expectations and actual Roman pragmatism. Mark Antony didn't care about the morality of a drowned teenager.
He just didn't care. Not at all. The Roman Empire operated on stability and tax revenue. Antony needed a ruthless middleman who could keep the volatile Judean regions subdued and profitable. Herod proved he was willing to do the incredibly dirty work required to maintain that order. To Antony, Herod was a highly useful monster.
Geopolitics over family tragedies, that makes sense. But that entire dynamic finally shifts in 31 BC with the Battle of Actium. Antony and Cleopatra are defeated by Octavian, who is soon to be the Emperor Augustus, and they commit suicide. So the Cleopatra problem is finally solved, and Herod masterfully pivots his loyalty to the new boss. But while his foreign policy is securing his throne, his domestic paranoia reaches a breaking point.
Right, and this is where we return to Mary Amchaim. Before Herod leaves to meet with Augustus, a meeting where he fully expects he might be executed for having supported Antony, he is consumed by the terrifying thought of another man taking his beloved wife. So he gives his most trusted bodyguard a secret order. He says, if I don't come back alive, kill Mary Am.
Which is an incredibly dark flavor of devotion. And the bodyguard, perhaps trying to prove to Mary Am just how indispensable she is to the king, leaks this order to her. He says, he loves you so much, he ordered me to kill you if he dies.
Yeah, spoiler alert, she didn't like that.
Shockingly, Mary Am does not find the threat of preemptive murder romantic. When Herod returns, triumphant and alive, she freezes him out entirely.
The environment inside the palace is a total powder keg at this point. And Herod's sister, Salome, likes the match. She absolutely despises the Hasmonean side of the family. So she seizes on Mariamne's coldness and falsely accuses the queen of sleeping with that very bodyguard.
And Herod is completely obsessed with Mariamne, but his deep-seated insecurity overrides everything. He actually believes the lie. He has the love of his life strangled to death in the exact same place they were married.
It's awful.
The psychological toll of that decision just shatters him. He goes on a near-fatal drinking binge. He physically survives it. But, I mean, you can't live a life filled with that much betrayal and murder without it breaking your mind.
No, you really can't. But paradoxically, as his mind crumbled, his ambitions exploded. Having wiped out his immediate rivals, he enters a period of unprecedented prosperity from 27 BC to 13 BC.
Okay, so a shift in focus.
Big time. He needs to prove his undeniable greatness to the Emperor Augustus. He needs to distract his angry subjects from his cruelty, and he desperately needs to secure a lasting physical legacy. So he turns to stone and mortar.
He becomes the master builder. Augustus had famously boasted that he found Rome a city of bricks and left it a city of marble. Herod wants to mirror that exact transformation in Judea. He decides to replace the modest Jewish temple that had stood since 515 BC. But here is the massive logistical hurdle. He knows the Jewish people will absolutely riot if an Idumean or any foreigner touches holy ground. Only consecrated priests are allowed in the inner courts.
The solution he engineers for this is nothing short of brilliant. Since ordinary stonemasons would defile the inner sanctum, Herod literally trains 1,000 Jewish priests to become carpenters and master builders.
Wait, really? He creates a holy construction crew.
Precisely. And he promises the populace he won't tear down the old temple until the new one is fully built. These priest carpenters construct the massive new temple complex right around the old one, and then they meticulously dismantle the old structure from the inside out.
That is wild.
They level a mountain. They use crushed stone to build an absolutely massive retaining platform, which includes what we now call the Western Wall. It became the largest religious complex in world history at the time.
Dr. Tomasino mentions that its gold roof shone so brightly it could be seen for miles out at sea. Even the rabbis, who utterly despised Herod's lineage and his violence, had to admit in their writings that you hadn't truly seen beauty until you saw Herod's temple. But he didn't stop at Jerusalem, did he? He wanted a world-class port to trade with Rome, so he built Caesarea.
Right, and Caesarea is a marvel because the coastline there had no natural bay. To build a stupendous Greek-style harbor out of nothing, Herod utilized a brand new technological invention, which was pozzolana, or Roman underwater concrete.
Underwater concrete.
Yeah. By mixing volcanic ash with lime and seawater, they created a substance that actually hardened while submerged. They lowered massive wooden forms into the Mediterranean, filled them with this concrete, and built an artificial harbor where nature had said it was impossible.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the psychological whiplash of Herod's public relations strategy is mind-boggling. It is like a modern politician running two completely contradictory ad campaigns on two different social media apps and just desperately hoping the algorithms never cross over.
Oh, totally.
Because to the Romans, he is funding massive pagan temples and Greek theaters. But locally, he is strictly enforcing kosher laws. He installs Jewish ritual bathing pools, or mikvahs, in his fortress palaces like Masada.
He even mints his local bronze coins without any human faces on them. Roman coins traditionally featured the emperor's profile. It was the standard way to project power. But Herod makes the calculated decision to use symbols like anchors or pomegranates instead.
Just to avoid offending the Jewish commandment against graven images.
Exactly.
The duality of it led to a famous quip from the Emperor Augustus. He supposedly said, "I'd rather be Herod's pig than Herod's son," which is a clever Greek pun on the words for pig and son, but it perfectly captures the dark absurdity of Herod's life. A pig in Herod's kingdom was perfectly safe because of the kosher dietary laws he rigidly enforced to keep the locals happy. Meanwhile, his own flesh and blood were constantly in danger of being executed for treason. That quip perfectly transitions us into the final, darkest chapter of his reign, from 13 BC to 4 BC, because all the beautiful architecture, the brilliant underwater concrete, the glittering gold roofs, none of it could quiet the demons in his mind. As his kingdom reached its absolute physical peak, his domestic life completely collapsed into violent, paranoid chaos.
Right, because he ends up having 10 wives in total.
Mm. And he starts playing this terrifying shell game with his own life. He would constantly move his court between his numerous, heavily fortified palaces like Masada, which was built on an isolated rock plateau without ever leaving a forwarding address.
Yeah, he was so terrified of assassins that nobody ever knew exactly where the king was sleeping on any given night.
And his family tree just turns into a bloodbath. Remember Doris, the very first wife he banished, and her son Antipater? In his paranoia, Herod recalls them to Jerusalem simply to provide a rival faction to his other children.
He deliberately seeds a succession crisis in his own house because Marianne's two sons, Alexander and Aristobulus, have returned from getting a fancy Roman education. And predictably, they absolutely hate their father for strangling their mother.
Can you blame them?
Not at all. But Salome, the sister who lied to get Miriam killed in the first place, starts slandering the boys to Herod, claiming they are plotting revenge. Herod, consumed by suspicion, has both of Miriam's sons executed.
The great tragedy of Herod's paranoia is that it functioned as a self-fulfilling prophecy. He killed people to stay safe, which made the populace and his family hate him, which meant he actually did have real enemies plotting against him. His eldest son, Antipater, the one he brought back from exile, really did plot to poison him.
And the assassination plot is incredible. Antipater smuggles poison from Egypt and gives it to Herod's cupbearer. But before the plot can be executed, the cupbearer accidentally drinks the poison wine himself and dies.
Wow, just terrible luck for the cupbearer.
Right. And Herod immediately investigates the sudden death, unravels the entire conspiracy, and has his eldest son executed.
The underlying mechanism here is a closed loop of terror. Violence spread hatred. Hatred bred conspiracies, and the conspiracies justified even more extreme violence in Herod's mind. And this raises the crucial context for the event we started this whole conversation with. It is within this deeply paranoid, blood-soaked context around 6 BC that the famous biblical slaughter of the innocents occurs in Bethlehem.
Exactly. So what does this all mean? We often look at the slaughter of the innocents as an isolated biblical story piece, but when you plug it into the very end of this timeline, it's not an anomaly. It's just a Tuesday for Herod.
Just another day in the talus.
Exactly the point Dr. Tomasino makes in his lecture. You have a 70-year-old tyrant who has already murdered his wife, his mother-in-law, his brother-in-law, and three of his own sons to protect his throne. He is hiding in desert fortresses.
So when a group of foreign magi show up in his capital asking about a newly born king of the Jews.
Oh, it triggers every paranoid delusion he has ever harbored. While some secular historians debate the specific historicity of the Bethlehem event because it isn't mentioned in Roman records, the psychological profile is a flawless match. Executing a handful of infants in a small village to neutralize a perceived threat is exactly the kind of arithmetic Herod performed daily.
He finally dies in 4 BC at the age of 70, rotting away from a gruesome, painful illness. And there is a dark historical legend that perfectly encapsulates his legacy. Supposedly, as he lay dying, he ordered the military to lock all the most notable men in Judea inside a stadium.
Right, the stadium order.
The standing order was to slaughter every single one of them the moment Herod stopped breathing. Why? Just to guarantee that there would be weeping and mourning in the land on the day of his death, even if they weren't crying for him.
Thankfully, his sister Salome finally did something decent and countermanded that order after he died, releasing the men. But the fact that the populace entirely believed he was capable of such a petty, massive slaughter tells you everything you need to know about the atmosphere of his reign.
Yeah, that says it all.
Upon his death, Rome refused to trust any of his surviving sons with the full kingdom. The territory was split among Archelaus, Antipas, and Philip, but they were merely appointed as regional governors. The unified, powerful kingdom of Herod died the exact second he did.
Which brings us to the final aha moment of this deep dive. With all this blood, all this terror, and a kingdom that immediately fractured upon his death, why does history remember him as Herod the Great?
Beyond the monumental buildings, the title The Great actually rests on a detail that fundamentally altered the course of history. Herod used his close, carefully cultivated relationship with the Emperor Augustus to secure vital legal rights. He negotiated for the Jewish people to have the legal right to live according to their own customs, observe the Sabbath, and bypass certain Roman civic duties throughout the entire Roman Empire.
Not just locally in Judea, but everywhere Roman roads went.
Everywhere. The invisible legislation he pushed through protected Jewish communities in Greece, in Italy, in Asia Minor. And here is why that is so vital. Even after the massive Jewish revolt in 70 AD, when the Romans burned the glorious physical temple Herod had built completely to the ground, those legal precedents remained intact.
That's amazing.
The rights Herod negotiated endured the destruction of his own city, and they played a massive role in ensuring the survival of the Jewish identity in the centuries of diaspora that followed.
Think about the heavy irony of that. Herod spent his entire life and spilled oceans of blood trying to build massive physical monuments out of stone and concrete to guarantee his legacy. He murdered the people who actually loved him to protect a throne he ultimately couldn't keep. But in the end, all those physical stones were torn down by the very empire he spent his life appeasing.
Yeah, the buildings didn't last.
The only thing of his that truly survived was a piece of invisible legislation, the abstract legal rights he negotiated for a people who absolutely despised him. It leaves you with a profound question. In our own lives and in our own work, are we obsessing over the tangible monuments we can build and see, while completely ignoring the invisible impacts and quiet influences that will actually outlast us?